National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
Day on Groundwire.
They have green-lighted Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline proposal with 209 conditions. So it's official. The war is on.
The Pride Parade is not merely that more people are out, but that our allies are with us marching. That's huge.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Benjamin Miller.
And I'm Rachel Swatek.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This week, Groundwire is produced on unceded Algonquin territory at CHUO in Ottawa. Coming up, sex workers and advocates across the country speak out against proposed prostitution laws. And Groundwire kicks off a summer celebrating Pride across Canada in Kingston, Ontario.
As well as a community radio report from Bella Coola, British Columbia, which is now home to a new Hulk language radio station.
That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire. But first, here are the headlines.
The following headlines come from Emily Philipson at CKUT in Montreal.
On June 10th, the Toronto City Council voted and approved implementation steps to ensure accessible services to people who don't have a full immigration status. Ting Shek from No One Is Illegal Toronto welcomed this news as it moves the city forward in its sanctuary city policy, but also expressed some reserve over how long the implementation is going to take.
There's already been long delays to get to this point. The original motion passed in February of 2013, and part of that motion was that the city staff would present a report and recommendations in the fall. But this didn't happen until a month ago. And so we're going to keep pushing to make sure that this implementation is reality.
Nonetheless, Ting Shek added that Toronto sets a precedent and activists can share their experience with other sanctuary city campaigns, as shown by Hamilton, which followed in Toronto's footsteps last February. The village of Winyima in Papua New Guinea is located near Barrick Gold's Porgera gold mine. On June 6, thousands of Winyima inhabitants were evicted from their homes, which were then burnt by police security forces. Nixon Mangampi, member of the Enga Province National Parliament, told advocacy group Protest Barrick that more than 200 houses were destroyed. Protest Barrick added that the local security forces justified this action, claiming the village was also home to miners not authorized by the government. Mangapi said the police's Operation Mikim Save was a response to demands from Barrick Gold to stop unauthorized mining in the region. According to Protest Barrick, the solution was backed by the company. Following the operation, unauthorized miners ran away, while thousands were left homeless. Barrick has consistently turned down requests for resettlement of all landowners around the mine and didn't make any statement following the June 6 raids.
You were just listening to headlines from Emily Philipson at CKUT in Montreal. The next headlines come from Catherine Fisher at CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
The government of BC has asked the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency to substitute a federal environmental review of a contentious zinc-lead mine proposal with a single provincial review. The Rudyk Creek Mine Project, which is owned by Vancouver-based Imperial Metals, is located at the headwaters of Rudyk Creek and Oliver Creek in the Monashee Mountain Range, a water system which is host to one of the world's greatest salmon runs. The mine is planned to have an annual production rate of 700,000 tons of ore per year for 10 to 15 years before it is closed. The project also envisions on-site processing facilities, access roads, a mill, tailings impoundments, and camp facilities. Jim Cooperman, president of the Shuswap Environmental Action Society, is concerned that the project may not require a federal environmental assessment. In a recent press release, he expresses the society's concern that the processing of the zinc-lead ore would require the storage of tailings above ground and in an alpine lake, and that this could pollute watercourses. The CS was also concerned that the proposed mine is located at a very high elevation near glaciers and the potential exists for problems related to avalanches and snowmelt. They also felt that the provincial review process has a history of approving projects that are not environmentally responsible, such as the Prosperity Mine, which was approved provincially but turned down twice in federal review. This proposed project is located within or near the traditional territory of the Simcoe Nation, the Adams Lake Band, the Little Shuswap Band, and the Nisqually-Sequepemec Nation. Members of the Nisqually-Sequepemec Nation say the project is located in unceded, unsurrendered Sequepemec territory and may affect local water sources and the people, salmon, and animals who depend on them. The Sequepemec Sacred Water Declaration, drafted in 2013 by some members of Sequepemec Nation, states, "We deny that Canada, the province of British Columbia, corporations, or any native bands have the right to make decisions in our land and water, as it is our collective responsibility as a nation. Therefore, we will not under any conditions support or take part in signing agreements, joint revenue sharing, and any other documents that compromise our responsibility." Catherine Fisher, GroundWire. More than 50 communities across BC held rallies, sit-ins, and other events this week opposing the federal government's decision to conditionally approve the Northern Gateway Pipeline project. The pipeline would move bitumen from the oil sands in Alberta to a proposed terminal near Kitimat, BC, and then on to international markets via oil supertanker ships. Many are concerned about the possibility of toxic oil leakage from the pipelines and the potential effects of catastrophic oil spills on the vulnerable coastal ecosystem. A number of First Nations in BC also unequivocally oppose the project. In Vancouver, more than 1,000 people gathered for an impromptu rally in front of the CBC Vancouver building on June 17th, the day the decision was announced. Representatives from Tsleil-Waututh, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam nations spoke at the rally, as did Grand Chief Stuart Phillip of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. The Carrier-Sekani Tribal Council organized a community rally in Prince George. Tribal Chief Terry Tegee said the northern community doesn't want the project. In Prince Rupert on Haida Gwaii, hundreds gathered in Mariners Park to approach the project. Speakers include Lux Qualum Hereditary Chief Murray Smith and representatives from Tsleil-Waututh and Haida Nations, with a performance by the Gixon Mission dancers. In Interior BC, 150 people gathered in the parking lot of the Czech Omica Mall in Nelson, BC. Many rally speakers recognized the Snakes Nation in their comments and expressed concern about the potential effects of the proposed supertankers on whales and marine life on the BC coast and the effect of possible pipeline spills on wildlife and water. In Port Moody in the Lower Mainland, several pipeline protesters occupied Conservative MP James Moore's office for the day on June 18th, resulting in several arrests. In spite of the federal government's conditional approval, the Northern Gateway project still faces major opposition. Several lawsuits are being filed to challenge the findings of a government joint review panel, which approved the project last year, and citizen groups are also working to organize a province-wide referendum. Project proponent Enbridge Inc. claims they have significant support of many First Nations governments, but at least 130 BC First Nations have gone on record as opposing the project. Catherine Fisher, GroundWire.
Gunarji O'Sullivan attended a rally against the Northern Gateway Pipeline on June 17th. The following are selections from a recap of that rally originally aired on Co-op Radio's Late Night with Savages.
I want to express my gratitude to the organizers who have brought us together on this important juncture of our collective journey.
We're listening to Grand Chief Stuart Phillip. And he was at the No Pipeline, still no to the pipelines forever. Here he is again.
You probably heard the Harper government has made it official. They have green-lighted Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal with 209 conditions. So it's official. The war is on. Today, the Harper government, in its usual thuggish and bullying manner, in its usual cowardly fashion, has declared war on everything the British Columbians and First Nations hold near and dear to our hearts.
There are people walking around, they're gathering towards the stage. As Cecilia Point, the MC for the day, gave us the opening, did a welcoming, and talked about what would happen. Here's Cecilia Point.
The First Nations people are still here, and that the fish and the whales and the coast. Always has been for thousands of years. That's our economy. He talks about jobs and economy. That's our economy. I personally work in the tourism industry, and that's my economy. People come from all over the world to see this beautiful, beautiful land, and we welcome them. So we don't want that destroyed. So we're going to get started following protocol with our three speakers, Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh. So I'll start with Audrey Siegel from Musqueam. We'll see you.
Nitsa Kwehwila Matanash from Musqueamah Tamos Tanawea. I Kunishkwalowans Kunzi Kutsnala. Artly Kunisqui, Tlitsanat, Humasquia. Kwai Puikten, Itzelina August, Tunansi Leh. Welcome to the traditional unceded land of the Musqueam people. My name is Audrey, and I am from Musqueam. The direct translation is I have feelings of great joy to see you all here today. And I do, but it's tinged with anger and sadness that we have to be here, that we have to do things like this yet again to make our voices heard. And trust me, our voices will be heard. Not because we will be, only because we are standing up for what is right. We are standing up for the way that it always should have been, and we will make sure that it goes back to that. We will protect the land, we will protect the air, and we will protect the water for ourselves, for the two-leggeds, for the four-leggeds, and for the winged, because that is our job. Protect.
That's all for headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. We'll be right back after Canada by the Xing Xing Regime.
Yeah, I'm from Canada. Triple goose maple syrup, homegrown in Canada. Nasty, nasty winter snow blowing in Canada. BC, coast to coast, yo, in Canada. Come up to Canada. Yeah, I'm from Canada. Triple goose maple syrup, homegrown in Canada. Nasty, nasty winter snow blowing in Canada. BC, coast to coast, yo, in Canada. Come up to Canada.
Yeah, I'm from Canada. Standing on top of the U.S. is Canada. No disrespect, but I know my parameters. The planet Earth is mine, but I'm living in Canada. And if you don't know, we staying Grammy in Canada. Where the rude boys carry them things to damage her with their eyes on peel. Always looking for amateurs. Immigration can't even handle us.
That was Canada by the Xing Xing Regime off their album Clean Cuts Originals. Welcome back to Groundwire, National Community Radio News from the National Campus and Community Radio Association. And now for our feature stories.
Canadian sex workers and advocates are speaking out against a proposed new prostitution bill. Amelie Philipson of CKUT in Montreal brings us this feature report on opposition to the tough new laws.
This month, the federal government has tabled its new prostitution legislation after the Supreme Court struck down three main provisions in this country's prostitution law last year because they created dangerous working conditions for sex workers. According to Robin Maynard from sex work advocacy group Stella, the new legislation is bringing back many of the same laws, but under different wording, which is concerning for sex workers.
So one of the laws being tabled that would be brought back is a law surrounding communicating. The communicating law was actually found by the Missing Women's Inquiry and a bunch of different government reports that already show that because it actually causes displacement of sex workers, it causes a much shorter ability of screening time of sex workers to negotiate with their clients. That actually increases by a large amount the dangers faced by sex workers. So they would be bringing this back. So what they changed about it is that within the wording is that it would have to be anywhere where a minor could possibly be present, although including public streets. Peter McKay even said that that could involve residential streets, anywhere where anybody, even up to the age of 17, could possibly be imagined to be. So even though there is sort of this extra stipulation, it really is looking like the same law. Something else that was proposed is a law against material benefits, against having material benefits gained of prostitution, even though a similar law was just struck down because it was shown that there is a difference between exploitative ways in which somebody can be gaining from a sex worker's money or somebody that she might be paying to work with her in terms of, say, other workers or somebody who helps her screen her clients. And though they're saying that this wouldn't target those people, it's very unclear in the legislation whether or not that's actually true.
According to Joyce Arthur from advocacy group First Decriminalize Sex Work in Vancouver, creating more dangerous working conditions for sex workers makes Bill C-36, this new law on sex work, unconstitutional, as it contradicts the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms protects people's right to life, liberty, security of the person, freedom of expression, and equality. So arguably all of these are breached by Bill C-36 because they prevent, again, sex workers from taking safety measures to protect themselves. They're forcing them back into the shadows. They're forcing them back out into the street instead of indoors where it's safer. They're recriminalizing third-party relationships, and sex workers, you know, don't always want to work alone. They often want to work with others and people like managers and so on, call screeners. These people can help keep sex workers safe. Can help facilitate their work for them. And some of these relationships will still be criminalized under the new law.
An article on CatholicRegister.org states that MP Joy Smith, who prepared the ground for the bill supporting the abolition of prostitution, said, "Prostitution exploits women, youth, and vulnerable populations. It escalates gender inequalities by turning women's bodies into a commodity to be bought, sold, rented, and exploited by men." Mrs. Scream from sex work advocacy group Big Susie's says that this isn't true and that today in Canada, a majority of sex workers are doing it as a choice.
But I do know that it is important for there to be labor rights for sex workers, just like there is for any other job, because a lot of people, I would even say most people in the sex industry, are doing it out of their own free will. And sometimes people are doing it out of financial desperation, but that's the job that they choose to do to be able to make the money.
Joyce Arthur confirmed that the government has taken what they call a moral position on sex work, and also said that conservative religious views are now in minority in today's Canadian society.
Canada is quite a secular country. We don't want, respect people's religious beliefs, but we also think that they should be private, their personal private things that should not be imposed on other people or on the population at large. And yet, in a way, that's exactly what's happening here.
Thanks to Joyce Arthur, Mrs. Scream, and Robin Maynard. This is Emily Phillipson for Groundwire.
Groundwire will celebrate Pride festivals across Canada this summer with feature stories from our country's diverse LGBTQ communities. Brenna Owen of CFRC Kingston's Alternative Frequency spoke to Patty, who marched in one of Kingston's first Pride parades. Patty shared her experience being out in Kingston and Washington, D.C. 30 years ago.
My name is Patty Rivera-Spencer. I'm 60 years old. I came out in Kingston 30 years ago and lived here between 1986 and 1993, more or less. And then I went away and then I came back in 2011. And in that time, I've seen a lot of changes in the queer community here. Partly when I think back on it, I didn't come out till I was 30 because there was no such thing as a healthy queer person. There was no community, no visible community that I could emulate. There was, you know, my mom never said, "Oh, you can grow up and love the man or woman of your choice." It was preconceived idea that I would be heterosexual. And when I contrast that to young people today, what I see is kids in ninth grade coming out. Usually they'll say they're bisexual first, in my experience, and then they'll come out and they'll say, "I'm gay," or "I'm lesbian," or "I'm trans," or "I'm whatever." So part of what I think has happened in these intervening 30 years is that by creating a visible community, by having events such as gay pride marches, and by being overtly in the world rather than concealed, we have made it possible for succeeding generations to build on what we've started. I used to live on a farm north of Westport before I moved to Kingston, and I used to go into Ottawa. And I went to an all-women's dance there for the first time in my life. I went to a place and I knew everybody was going to be a lesbian. And I walked into that huge hall filled with women, and I was just astounded that there were so many of us, number one. But part of it for me, the transforming part of that dance for me was that I saw women who were professional, who laughed, who loved other people, who were kind, who were funny. You know, I mean, I had to have a role model. I had no role model until I walked into that dance and I saw these women who were perfectly well put together, you know. So we lacked the role models and we became role models for each other. We were invisible in the sense that we were deviants, we were other, we were hidden. I was outed to my sister who lives in Kingston. And she called me after finding out that I was a lesbian. She called me at 2 o'clock in the morning, just weeping. And when I picked up the phone, I thought, oh God, mom died. And her perception was that I was going to become a part of this dark underworld, that I was going to do drugs and I was going to frequent really seedy places and somehow that I would stop being who I am. So that was the perception of queerness back even as recently as the 1980s. And that's all I knew about being queer as well, right? Was that image that society portrayed of queer people.
You mentioned when we met that you march in, you think, what maybe was the first Kingston Pride Parade, but, mm-hmm. you know, it was on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that kind of Kingston Pride way back then?
Yeah, it was, again, it was a nascent organization, and we didn't claim the main street, and it was a bunch of people who had the guts to just go out and proclaim who they were. That I do feel that it took courage to do that in this town, because we could literally, you know, we'd be beaten up if we were identified as being queer. It exposed us to harassment and torment and so on to do that. But we also had learned that you can't be healthy and be hidden about who you are. We learn to hate queer people before we realize that that's who we are. As children around a kitchen table, we adopted those attitudes. And then one day we woke up and said, oh my God, that's me. So there was that kind of internalized homophobia. And part of beating that is to say, no, I'm still who I am. I'm a decent person. I'm kind. I'm loving. I don't deserve to be mistreated this way. From that comes the willingness to say, I'm going out and I'm being who I am and I'm taking the chance of that, because I'd rather be crucified for being honest than crucified for being a liar. I think some of the big changes are that the people that I see really actively organizing today are much younger than we were. Probably university students, like young university students. You see a lot of high school kids that are participating in the parade, which we would not have seen in that day. We see today a huge number of supporters and allies. We were just us, we were just a handful of queer people. And now it's, you know, churches that come out in support of us, and, you know, military organization, the military, we had a tank in our parade 2 years ago. So we really, there are huge changes, and in the size of the Pride Parade is not merely that more people are out, but that our allies are with us marching. That's huge.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. New Hawk Radio 91.1 FM launched in Bella Coola, British Columbia on June 21st. The station will broadcast in the New Hawk language to educate and promote language use. I spoke to Banshee Hanyus from New Hawk Radio 91.1 FM.
This must be a really exciting time. You're about to launch the station. Can you tell me about what's going on right now? You just started broadcasting on air and you're about to get online.
Basically, gosh, I don't know where to start, because we're doing everything right now.
What's the experience been like just getting everything going?
When we started out, we didn't put a lot of thought into what it actually takes to start a radio station. So it is a bit overwhelming, but it's very exciting and our community's excited. And we've seen, you know, even changes in our community already with people starting to use the New Hulk language more, like saying things like hello in New Hulk, whereas before we didn't even hear basic things like that as much anymore. But you turn on the radio and you hear the language, and it's finally an opportunity for people to listen to the New Hulk language, whereas before we didn't hear it very much because we only have around 15 fluent speakers remaining.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? What made you decide to start broadcasting your language on air to really spread it?
We have only about 15 New Hulk language speakers remaining in our community, and there aren't a lot of opportunity for people to learn the New Hulk language. We have our own school, the Asokta School, but the language isn't taught very much there because we don't have a lot of speakers, so we don't have a lot of teachers. And it's hard to learn the language if you don't use it, or sorry, hear it. So our mission of our radio station was to promote, not only to promote the language use, but to inspire new learners and raise the prestige of our language and reaffirm the fact that the New Hulk language is relevant today.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me about how that's going to work on air? What sort of stuff are you going to do? Will it be all in New Hulk? Will it be some English? How's it going to play out?
We'd love to do it all in New Hulk, but because we don't have enough speakers, we have to rely on some recordings that were done back in the 70s, New Hulk language repetition, like words being repeated in New Hulk and in English. We also have a linguist from University of Victoria that's been working with us. He's doing his PhD in language curriculum right now, and he's been working with us to help us document our language as well as to teach our teachers. And he's been working with our elders and airing the kind of like the raw recordings on our station, and they've been a real hit in the community so far.
What kind of response have you gotten from people in the community to your station and just sharing the language?
People are definitely excited, and we hear people like children that love listening, and even elders. And with a lot of the elders, because they don't hear the language, the New Hulk language, that much anymore, it's harder for them to, I guess, speak it. And apparently now that they're listening to it on the radio station, a lot of their words are coming back, and a lot of stuff that they have maybe kind of forgotten is coming back. So that's really exciting.
What are you most looking forward to going forward with the station?
I'm most looking forward to this station helping increase the fluency or increase the number of speakers, New Hulk language speakers in our community, getting people excited about the New Hulk language, but also about us asserting New Hulk nationhood and promoting stewardship of our homelands, and the station contributing positively to the physical, mental, spiritual, emotional well-being, which is greatly needed in our community. Our station is located on reserve in Bella Coola, and I just think it can be a very powerful tool for our community in terms of education on many levels, as well as how to sustain a local, healthy, environmentally friendly community and economy.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire from CHUO in Ottawa, Ontario. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Rachel Swatek.
And I'm Benjamin Miller. Music this week was by the Xing Xing Regime. We thank contributors Emily Phillipson, Catherine Fisher, Gunarji O'Sullivan, and Brenna Owen. Groundwire would also like to thank Carly Forbes, CHUO in Ottawa, Olivier Charbonneau, Joel Ladouceur, and Aaron Flynn.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.